Genesis part 20. We're in chapter 18 this evening. And last time we got through about half of the chapter, so we're going to start in verse 16 tonight. And of course, last week in chapter 18, the three men show up at Abraham's tent, if you were with us last week. And when they showed up, Abraham was very hospitable and immediately had Sarah make dinner for them all, and they sat down to dinner. And of course, they inquired about Sarah, Abraham's wife, and doing so, they inquired or made the comment that Sarah would have, that this time next year, Sarah would have a son. If you look at verse 10, he said, "I will certainly return unto thee according to the time of life, and lo, Sarah, thy wife, shall have a son." And of course, Sarah was in the tent, and she laughed when she heard that. But as we find out that as we go through the verses, we find out that one of the men is, of course, the Lord, and the other two, as we're going to find out, are angels. But they, as so often happens in the Bible, they appear as men. And by this time in the conversation, Abraham, of course, I'm certain, knows that who he's dealing with by this time, because of the promise that had been made prior, and now that they've inquired about Sarah and said that you are going to have a son, Abraham, I'm certain, knows that he is dealing with the Lord face to face. So if he didn't know it at first when the three men showed up, he most certainly knows at this point. So as we pick up the story in verse 16, the three men are still there. And Abraham is going to learn about justice and judgment from God. And it's going to be a very important lesson. Justice and judgment. And it's not going to be the justice and judgment of man, but rather how God handles justice and judgment. So as we pick up the story, the Lord and the angels rise up from eating their meal with Abraham. Verse 16, "And the men rose up from thence and looked towards Sodom, and Abraham went with them to bring them on the way." Now if you remember, Abraham is to be the father of many nations. So he of course, needs to know the principles of justice and judgment in order to teach those. And so those principles then would be passed to his children and their children, and passed down to the nations, so that those nations then would have God's principles of how to carry out justice and judgment on those who need to be judged. You know, that's one of the foundations of the nation that we live in, the United States of America. We have a constitution, we have a justice system, and a system of judgment of those who, require judgment. If you have a dispute between two parties, there's a system of judging, who's right and who's wrong, and a system of carrying out justice for those who are, who have had wrong done to them. So it's important to have principles of that in place, and not man's principles, but rather God's principles of how those things are to be carried out, justice and judgment. So it's important that Abraham understand this. So here we find in verse 17, the Lord said, "Shall I hide from Abraham that thing which I do, seeing that Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him? For I know him, that he will command his children and his household after him, and they shall keep the way of the Lord to do justice and judgment, that the Lord may bring upon Abraham that which he has spoken of him." So that which God is intending to do, what he means there is, I'm not going to hide that which I'm going to do. So that Abraham can learn from what happens. You know, oftentimes carrying out judgment is not an easy thing to do. You know, Fern's a grandparent, and your grandkids are here on Sundays. Firsthand that judging, if there's a problem, that judging who's right and who's wrong isn't always easy, is it? And carrying out justice, this person gets this person gets that, isn't always easy either. But there's principles of how to, carry out justice and judgment. And that is exactly what God is saying here. You know, shall I hide that which I am going to do? Well, no, he's not going to hide what he's going to do, even though it's not a desirable thing. I mean, everybody's familiar with what happens to Sodom and Gomorrah. You know, this is not a new teaching. And most people are, a lot of people have a view of life that, and they want to go through life with blinders on, like nothing bad ever happens. All they want to have is tunnel vision. And they don't want to see the bad things around them. Well, the fact of the matter is there are things that happen in the normal course of life, even in the most desirable of circumstances, that require judgment. And they require justice. And without that, then if you don't use justice and you don't use good judgment, then, well, you have inequity all the time, and you have you don't have any judgment between people. So you just have a poor system. So the example here is going to be Sodom and Gomorrah, an extreme example, no doubt, but an excellent example. So the Lord said, verse 20, "Because the cry of Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grievous, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the cry of it, which has come unto me, and if not, I will know." Let me stop there for a minute and ask you, did God know what had happened in Sodom and Gomorrah up to this point? Did he need to go down to Sodom and Gomorrah and find out firsthand, look around and interview people and peek in doors and get the full report from the, or did he already know what was going on there?
He knew. Paul or somebody tells you that everything is naked and open to his eyes.
Yeah.
I don't know where it is exactly.
Yeah, of course he knew. Of course he knew. So why would he, why would he say this? What was the purpose of this kind of language? That God would go down there. This is, remember, this is the same thing that we found in at the Tower of Babel. Here's Nimrod, and he says, "Let us build us a tower so that, up to the heavens, so that God can't make us, scatter us throughout the earth, and he can't flood us out again, and we're going to build us a tower and make us a name, so, we're going to be our own gods." And of course, everybody's speaking their language, and God looks down and says, maybe we ought to go down there and take a look, see what's happening, and, figure out what's going on down there and see if we ought to put an end to it. Did God really need to go down and look around and poke around at the Tower of Babel and say, "Well, I don't think this is a good idea," and, send a few lightning bolts down? Is that easy? But that's the kind of language that you found in chapter 11 of Genesis. Is that what God needed to do? Go down, poke around, or send some people down, you know, some angels to spy around? Is that what God needed to do, or did he know already what it was that was going on at the Tower of Babel? He already knew, didn't he?
Yeah.
But you find that same kind of language. What's the point of that language is the question. What's the point? You know, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the cry of it, which has come unto me, and if not, I will know. Why does it say that? Well, God's taking person. What it shows here is just that God's taking a personal interest in these events. That's, you know, as we read through the text, God knows everything that's going on. God knows what's going on in my mind. God knows what you know Mike's thinking over here. God knows the hearts of men. But the fact of the matter is as we read through this particular text, it shows that God is taking a personal interest in this particular circumstance here of Sodom and Gomorrah. And so we're concentrating on Sodom and Gomorrah, and God is focused on that. It's not that he's disregarding the rest of the universe, but he's focusing on this for the moment. So that we as men can understand. Because we can't focus on the entire universe all at once. We can only focus on one thing and then think about maybe a couple things at the same time. God is focusing on Sodom and Gomorrah. So we're gonna see if what we think is going on really is going on. And that's what God is saying. And if not, I'll know the difference. And so, verse 22, the men turned their faces from thence and went towards Sodom. But Abraham stood yet before the Lord. So the Lord didn't go with the other two men, which, as we find out later, are really angels. So the Lord and Abraham stay where they're at, and the other two men, the angels, that look like men and act like men and eat like men, they go towards Sodom, and Abraham and the Lord are left alone. So the Lord really doesn't have to go to Sodom to find out what's going on. He knows already. Well, as it turns out, Abraham must have known what the Lord had in mind. Because in verse 23, Abraham draws near to the Lord. Abraham draws near to the Lord. And it says, and Abraham drew near and said, "Wilt thou also destroy the righteous with the wicked?" Now, nowhere before here does it say that God is going to destroy Sodom. That hasn't even been mentioned yet. But Abraham knows what it is that God is fixing to do. He knows what's going to happen. So, Abraham knows what God is fixing to do. He knows what's going on in Sodom. I guess it must have been well known what was going on in Sodom. And that God was going to judge. Abraham knew that, well, God's going to judge and do that which he needs to do. So, but what's Abraham's concern here? What's Abraham's real concern?
Lot
and his family. That's exactly right. Because Lot and his family live in Sodom. And that's his nephew. So, Abraham drew near and said, "Wilt thou also destroy the righteous with the wicked?" So, what Abraham is concerned with is the justice of God. Is it a just thing? Of course there's going to be judgment. God's going to judge the wicked. But is it a just thing to judge the righteous along with the wicked at the same time? And to, if the wicked are guilty, then they need to be judged. But is it a right thing for the innocent to be what we would call in the, you know, in military terms, collateral damage. Haven't you ever heard that term? We're, you know, when the United States goes to war and we fire off a bomb and maybe it goes a little astray somewhere and we say, oops, it landed in the library instead of hitting you know where we thought it was going to hit. Well, there was collateral damage. They never say a bunch of innocent people got killed. They always say, well, there's collateral damage. So that's what Abraham is concerned about, collateral damage, innocent people getting killed, the people that don't deserve to have justice carried out on them. So he says, wilt thou also destroy the righteous with the wicked? Well, of course, he's concerned about Lot and his family living in Sodom. And if you look at just ahead a little bit in chapter 19, verse 27 through 29, you find out that Abraham got up early. Now, this, of course, is after Sodom and Gomorrah were carpet bombed by God. Abraham got up early, this is the next morning, to the place where he stood before the Lord, and he looked toward Sodom and on Gomorrah, and toward all the land in the plain, and beheld, and lo, the smoke of the country went up as the smoke of a furnace. And it came to pass, when God destroyed the cities of the plain, that God remembered Abraham, and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow, when he overthrew the cities in which Lot dwelt. So, you know, God knew the heart of Abraham, that God was concerned for Lot. Even though Abraham will never say to God, God, I'm really concerned about my nephew Lot. Can you make sure that he and his family get out of there safe? Abraham never once says that. He just says, are you going to destroy the righteous with the wicked? And so, Abraham begins with really what would seem like a modest number. I mean, you think about a city, and you think, well, how big is a city? How big is a city, Mike? We don't know how big Sodom was, but how big is a city?
Gigantic.
Might be gigantic, but back then, I suppose, let's say it was 5,000 people. Okay? And so out of 5,000, Abraham begins with what you think would maybe a small number. He says, peradventure, there be 50 righteous within the city. So that's one. Is that 1%? That would be 1%, wouldn't it? Yeah, that'd be 1%. If 1% of the people were righteous, wilt thou also destroy and not spare the place for the 50 righteous that are within? So Abraham says, if you can find 50 people that are righteous, you know, will you still destroy the city? And then he says, that be far from thee to do after this manner, to slay the righteous with the wicked, and that the righteous should be as the wicked, that be far from me. Shall not the judge of all the earth do right, Abraham says. He says, you know, I'm sure that'd be far from you, God, to slay the righteous with the wicked. You know, I'm sure you're a lot better than that, God. You know, shouldn't the judge of the earth do right? You know, Abraham's laid it on thicker and heavier as he goes. Well, of course, this argument he doesn't have to make, but it's funny that, you know, that Abraham makes this argument to the Lord. You know, aren't you God? You know, aren't you the God that does right? And you know, well, of course, the Lord's going to agree. And so the Lord says, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I'll spare all the place for their sakes. I won't destroy the city. Well, as you read through this, it's teaching a valuable lesson. And, you know, most people will read through all this and completely miss the lesson that it's teaching. So to grasp the concept that is being taught here, it's more than just high-low with the Lord. You know, let's agree on a number, although I think it's comical that way. But it really is more than just playing high-low with the Lord. Let's, you know, agree on the number of people that, you know, we can, the fewest number of people that we can find and still not destroy the city. What is it that's being taught here? As we live in this world today, are there righteous people in the world? Yes, there are. Are there also wicked people in the world? Absolutely. You got to think to yourself, God has promised to destroy the wicked. We find that in the Word of God, haven't we? What keeps Him from destroying the wicked? What keeps Him from doing the same thing to the wicked as He did to Sodom and Gomorrah?
The righteous people that are down here.
The righteous people that are down here.
Let the wheat and the tares grow up together.
Turn to Matthew chapter 13. Matthew chapter 13. So there is a principle at work here. There's a principle at work here, and it's taught in more than one place in the Bible. In Matthew chapter 13, verse 24, here is the Lord, and another parable put he forth unto them, saying, the kingdom of heaven is likened unto a man which soweth good seed in his field. But while men slept, his enemy came and sowed tares among the wheat, and went his way. But when the blade was sprung up and brought forth fruit, then appeared the tares also. So the servants of the householder came and said unto him, Sir, didst thou not sow good seed in thy field? From whence then came tares? And said unto them, an enemy hath done this. The servant said unto him, wilt thou then go, that we go and gather them up? But he said, nay, lest while ye gather up the tares, ye root also the wheat with them. Let both grow together until the harvest. And in the time of harvest, I will say to the reapers, gather ye together first the tares, and bind them in bundles to burn them, but gather the wheat into my barn. So you have tares and wheat growing up together all over the world. And in Sodom and Gomorrah, you have righteous and wicked. You have tares and wheat. And all the question is how many tares and how compared to how much wheat? That's the only question involved. So, back in Genesis, Abraham lowers the bar on the amount of wheat. Because he got to thinking about that 50 righteous and says, well, maybe I'm setting the bar too high. And in Genesis 18, verse 27 and 28, Abraham answered and said, behold now, I have taken upon me to speak unto the Lord, which am but dust and ashes. He says, I'm nothing, but yet I'm speaking to you. He says, peradventure, there shall lack 5 of the 50 righteous. Wilt thou destroy all the city for lack of 5? And he said, if I find there 45, I will not destroy it. So again, Abraham lowers the number. In verse 29, he spake unto him yet again and said, peradventure, there shall be 40 found there. And the Lord said, I will not do it for 40's sake. Fearing the Lord's anger, of course, because, you know, you think, how often can I do this and how long? Abraham lowers the number again because he wants to get down as far as he can. Verse 30, he said unto him, oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak. Peradventure, there shall 30 be found there. And the Lord said, I will not do it if I find 30 there. So again, the number gets lowered. In verse 31, and he said, behold now, I have taken upon me to speak unto the Lord, peradventure, there shall be 20 found there. And he said, I will not destroy it for 20's sake. Now, no doubt Abraham believed that Lot and his family, because Lot had his wife and he had
two daughters,
two son-in-laws, and then there's servants and such like. He figured 10 would be enough to cover Lot and his family. I mean, Abraham's obviously doing the math in his head. So he's working the way down and thinking, I've got to at least cover Lot. And you know that's what he has in his mind. So in verse 32, he says, Oh, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak yet but this once. Peradventure 10 shall be found there. And the Lord said, I will not destroy it for 10's sake. So after the final number is agreed to, the Lord and Abraham go their ways. And in verse 33, the Lord went his way as soon as he had left communing with Abraham, and Abraham returned unto his place. So 10 is the final number that they agreed to. So what you see illustrated is a diminishing number of righteous as compared to the wicked. You have an increasing percentage of wicked in Sodom compared to a diminishing percentage of righteous. Abraham started at 50 and ended up at 10. That same principle, then, is what Paul teaches in 2 Timothy 3:13, that evil men and seducers shall wax worse and worse, deceiving and being deceived. So that evil will always be increasing and will prosper and will keep progressing and moving forward. People of true faith are going to be reduced in number to an evidently small percentage. Who knows what percentage that was? Over time, faithfulness in God, whether you call it Christianity, whether you call it whatever you want to call it, has been through fits and bounds. I mean, it's expanded and contracted. It's, you know, depending on the particular time. When the Lord showed up, of course, you had this expansion after the apostles. You know, with the apostles, you know, in one day, thousands were saved. But then, of course, with the persecution of the church, you had years where, you know, thousands and millions over the centuries were killed for their faith. You know, you come up to the time of Martin Luther. All through the Dark Ages, the church, you couldn't even call it a church. It's just a false church. The true believers were hiding out somewhere, trying to, you know, keep from being killed. You know, in the time of the Reformation, faith grew again. You know, it's been, like I say, in and out, up and down. It's always been that way. But in the end times, people of true faith are going to be reduced. And that's exactly what this teaches, is that as wickedness increases, faith will decrease. And Paul teaches that in 1 Timothy 4:1, that in the latter times some shall depart from the faith, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of devils. Sodom and Gomorrah is really the benchmark of sin pertaining to justice and judgment. God's teaching Abraham to teach others, to teach the nations about justice, that a system of justice, and a system of judging others and how God judges and how God deals out justice. Jude 1:7 says, "Even as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities about them in like manner, giving themselves over to fornication and going after strange flesh, are set forth for an example." That was the purpose of it, to be an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. And there was a purpose for those cities. They were put forth as an example of God's justice and judgment. So they're to be used as that and to be understood as that. You find reference to Sodom and Gomorrah tons of times throughout the Bible. And that's the reason why, is because they are to be understood as that. And the world, you know, understand this, that the world will spiritually be moving toward will be moving toward becoming a spiritual Sodom. The farther we get toward a time of judgment. The acceptance and legalization of same-sex marriage. That's exactly right. That you know, that was the sin at Sodom and Gomorrah. The great sin at Sodom and Gomorrah was homosexuality and free sex and whatever was going on there. Just a loose morality in general.
Yeah, people read this and they think that today, you know, they're doing something different than what people did then.
Yeah.
And they're not.
No. No, sexual perversion has always been in style.
I was with my two grandsons that came down here on Sunday, and their dad was outside cutting grass, and we saw a rainbow in the sky. So I showed my grand, I said, "There's a rainbow." We got kids, so they came running to see that rainbow. So I asked Desmond about the rainbow and told him about Noah and how God made a covenant with Noah. The next day I was at work, and this woman said to me, "Did you see a rainbow yesterday?" And something just hit me like, this is a good opportunity, because that rainbow in the sky, as pretty as it is, pretty as it is, and people running around today saying gay marriage is right and God made me like this and all of these things, but that rainbow is a sign that God did once judge the world, because He put that bow in the sky after He did it. So, as pretty as it is, God says He looks down on it and we look up at it. But it's a sign for people today that He did judge the world. Indeed, He's going to do it again.
That's right. That's right. Well, and all the things that you see going on today have gone on before. So, this isn't the first time that morality has been lax in the world, without a doubt. But it's always, it has always brought the judgment of God. And, God's no more hip than He was the first time.
It's like Isaiah, he knew when he first spoke to Abraham about the cry from Sodom and Gomorrah. He knew. But he went down for Abraham's sake, so because he could have just sent a bullet like them from the sky.
He could have just destroyed them. That's right. But he went down in order to teach Abraham about God's justice and God's judgment, and so that we can, as Jude says, learn, because they were made an example. And so there's a reason why God paid special attention to them. If you look at fornication, if you look at all these things that that are dealt with in the Bible that, you know, are denied as being sin by so many. You know, and if you're homosexual, you can find Bibles these days that don't mention the sin of homosexuality. But, you know, there's a lot of people that are homosexual that say, well, you know, homosexuality is not a sin in the Bible. God doesn't care if you're homosexual. You know, homosexual, this, that, and the other thing. Yes, he does.
They didn't see those two men that were with Christ when the people inside wanted to molest those angels.
That's right.
And they smote them right there on the spot.
Yeah.
They don't see that.
So, you know, it's an example. Every example is here for a purpose, and this example is here as an example of what is going to happen again. You know, as we move farther toward the spiritual Sodom that we had at, you know, we had a real Sodom at one time. As we move closer and closer to being the spiritual Sodom again, and look at Revelation chapter 11, starting in verse 7. This is a description of the condition at the time of God's judgment. This is talking about the two prophets that will prophesy for 3.5 years. When they will have finished their testimony, the beast that ascendeth out of the bottomless pit will make war against them and will overcome and kill them. And the dead bodies shall lay in the street of the great city, which spiritually is called Sodom and Egypt, where our Lord was crucified. So there's the condition of you know, the world, the spiritual Sodom, because that is the religious that's where the religious leadership of the world comes from, right there. That's Jerusalem. And of the people and kindreds and tongues and nations shall see their dead bodies 3.5 days, and shall not suffer their bodies to be put in the graves. And they that dwell upon the earth shall rejoice over them and make merry, and shall send gifts one to another, because these two prophets tormented them that dwell on the earth. So people will be happy that they're dead, because they'll be led by this system of spiritual sodomy, basically. You know, so the system that says homosexuality is fine, you know, marriage between same sex is fine, and you know, whatever you feel like is fine, and is going to endorse all these things. There, that's the same system that's going to kill the two prophets, and everybody's going to be following that system and rejoicing and having another holiday because they're dead. So it's a false and perverted system. So that's the condition of the world at that particular time. But as long, just like you saw in when Abraham was dealing with God and worked his way down from 50 to 10, and God said, as long as we can find these numbers, I'll spare the city. If you look at 2 Thessalonians in chapter 2, you see that as long as there are sufficient numbers of righteous in the world, God's justice and judgment will be withheld. Read Paul, 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 3. Paul says, let no man deceive you by any means, for that day shall not come, except two things happen, except there come a falling away first, and the man of sin be revealed, the son of perdition. And Paul says, verse 6, now you know what withholdeth, that he might be revealed in his time. So, until falling away from the faith comes, and there aren't enough righteous here that God deems it worthy that there's enough wheat left in the field to warrant the tares not being torn out, then then justice is going to be withheld, or judgment is going to be withheld. So that teaches an important lesson. It teaches an important principle that God uses as justice and judgment. Another thing is, Paul says that we have, people always worry about God's judgment being poured out And there's no worry about that, because God's judgment will not be poured out on the righteous. Anyway, you know, on the righteous at the same time as it is with the wicked, in the future any more than it was at Sodom and Gomorrah. He'll get the righteous out before the wicked are judged. Paul says it. We have examples in the past of it. It's just so as Jude says, it's an example, and we can believe it. Now, as we look at Abraham, one of the things that we can, there's a few things that we can learn from him. If you notice, when he talks to God this time and has a conversation with God, what's going on here is he is maturing as a person. He's maturing as a believer. And I just wanted to point out some things that were going on in his life that may be obvious, but may be useful in your life and your faith also. One of the things is that Abraham did not have to rely on miracles or spectacular events. God appeared as a man. God and the angels appeared as a man, and Abraham knew who he was by what he said. He didn't expect incredible things. He was able to talk to God as an ordinary. He was able to recognize God for who he was and talk to him on an intimate level. The relationship is also becoming much more intimate. You think about the anything that you've ever done in life with someone who you were very close to. Generally, it's always at some point involves a meal, the sharing, you know, the eating food. You sit down and eat. Whether it's someone you love, or you know, someone you've dated, someone that you're friends with. Abraham immediately fixes and shares a meal with these three men, shares a meal with the Lord. If you remember, sharing the Passover was one of the Lord's greatest desires with his apostles before he went to the cross. And their eyes were opened. In Luke chapter 22, verse 30 and 31, their eyes were opened to the scriptures that he was had to die and would then be resurrected. And that happened at the sharing of the meal, just as Abraham's eyes were opened at the sharing of the meal to who the Lord was, as he gave revelation to Sarah that she would be the she would bear a son that time next year. As Paul says, the fellowship of believers is always shared over a meal. In 1 Corinthians 11, 23 through 36, that's the fellowship of our faith in the Lord Jesus Christ is always shared over the Lord's Supper. Another thing that came to my mind is with Abraham, the attention was shifted off of him to others. When the three men arrived, didn't have anything to do with him. It was, what could he do for them? The first thing he did was he welcomed them and said, come and sit down and let me fix you, you know, a meal. And he called for Sarah and said, quick, get, you know, make biscuits and make meat. And he went and slaughtered an animal and you know, made the whole meal and made them comfortable. And everything was all about them. Then after the meal, he didn't ask for anything. He interceded on behalf of others. even though he might have had Lot on his mind, his interceding with God, directly with God, was all on behalf of others. It had nothing to do with anything that he wanted, needed, or anything else. It was all on behalf of others. And our maturity, as we grow in faith and maturity, we know when to act and when to be still, when not to do a thing. You know, one of the mistakes that Abraham made, we've talked about a lot of the mistakes and the ramifications that come back to bite him after a long time even. You know, one of the mistakes that Abraham made when he acted when he shouldn't have, he went to Egypt. And there, of course, he tried to pass off Sarah as his sister, and all the problems that that caused. You know, even 10 years later, all those things came back to bite him. He didn't act when God first said, go to Canaan. He did not act then. Then when, of course, Sarah said, go lie with my slave. Hagar, he was too passive and followed the will of Sarah in all things. He should have put his foot down, and he was too passive, and he should have acted, and he didn't. So being mature in your relationship with God, and knowing when to act and when not to act, and when to do something and when not to do something, oftentimes makes the difference between making a huge mistake and doing the right thing. And you see that in Abraham's life, and that he was made plenty of mistakes, and sometimes it was because he acted impetuously, sometimes because he didn't do anything at all. So maturity oftentimes is the answer to that. This time, when Abraham interceded on behalf of others, he did so according to the will of God and his God's plan, which is a very mature thing to do. He interceded according to the will of God and God's plan. God had announced, should I hide this thing which I plan to do, and did not hide which he was going to do according to his judgment and the justice that he was going to carry out on Sodom and Gomorrah. And Abraham did not seek to stop God in carrying out judgment. He didn't seek to change God's plans, but rather he acted according to what God was going to do. And he interceded on behalf of the righteous according to what God's plans already were, which is a very mature thing to do. See, Abraham knew what God was going to do, as we do. And we have this book here which tells us what God's plan and purpose is in the future, things called prophecy. So we have a very good knowledge of what's going to happen in the future. Not necessarily when exactly, but what we can have a pretty good handle on. And so did Abraham. He knew what was going to happen. Knowing what's going to happen shouldn't just incite curiosity, which it does for a lot of people. You know, a lot of people turn to the book of Revelation, for instance, and start reading that because they're curious. I got to know what's going to happen. You know, what's the beast, and what are these strange creatures back here, and when's it going to happen, and how's it going to happen, and who's it going to happen to, and all the things that go on. What's going to happen in the future, and when, and that's what they want to do. It incites curiosity. Well, if you notice, Abraham knew what was going to happen, and it didn't incite his curiosity. He didn't ask God, well, how are you going to do that? He said, his first question is, are you going to destroy the righteous with the wicked? Is that really the right thing to do? Would a just God do that? He didn't say, Lord, are you going to use lightning bolts or balls of fire? Is the angel of death going to, go through the streets and with a sword and cut off their head? He didn't ask any of those, the hows or whys. He says, is it really right for the righteous to die with the wicked? And so rather than inciting curiosity, it moved him to action. It moved him to action, knowing what was going to happen. So that was the result of maturity. And so knowing what's going to happen in our future, knowing that, as Paul says, wicked people will wax worse and worse, knowing that there will be believers who fall away from the faith, knowing that there will be those who teach doctrines of devils and such like, knowing that there will be those who won't listen to the truth, they won't endure sound doctrine, knowing that there will be a day when the Lord returns, it should not just incite us to curiosity, but rather should move us to action. Knowing, first of all, that there are saints who haven't really been edified to the point where they can stand against what Paul says is the wiles of the devil. So they need to be built up to that point where they can stand on their own. And there are also people who aren't saved. And they need to be saved before the day comes. Lastly, Abraham did not seek to change God's mind in destroying Sodom and Gomorrah. He didn't say, boy, you know what? That's some of those people down there, I know they're wicked, but you know, maybe someday they'll get saved. Why don't you let me go down there and talk to them? I'll take some tracts down there and hand them out and go tell them about homosexuality and how you hate it. And spend some time down there. Maybe, set up a church right outside the front doors of the entrance to the city. And, over time, maybe some people will attend on Sunday morning and you might get to save a few of those people. It's worth a try. So why don't you put off your judgment for, 15, 20 years, and we'll see if we can save a few of them before we do that. That's what we do today. That's what we do today. But Abraham didn't do that. Abraham didn't do it. He knew what God's plan was. He knew it was going to happen, and he didn't seek to change it. He didn't seek to change God's mind. Rather, he acted according to the mind of God. He acted according to God's mind. God was going to carry out His justice and lay out judgment on Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding cities. because they had acted wickedly. And all Abraham's going to do was act according to the mind of God, what God was going to already do. And in demonstrating compassion and mercy and justice, Abraham demonstrating the mind of God. The mind of God, which Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 9 through 16, where we'll end up this evening. He says, "But as it is written, I have not seen nor ear heard, neither have entered into the heart of man the things which God hath prepared for them that love him. But God hath revealed them unto us by his Spirit, for the Spirit teacheth all things, yea, the deep things of God." You know, Abraham didn't have to ask God, "Are you going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah?" Did you notice that? He never once, God didn't say, "I'm going down there to destroy the cities." All God said is, "Should I hide that which I am going to do?" Seeing as how Abraham is going to be the father of many nations. And immediately Abraham's question was, are you going to destroy the righteous with the wicked? He knew what God was going to do. He knew the mind of God. God revealed it to him by the Spirit. Paul says, "For what man knoweth the things of a man, save the spirit of man which is in him?" So we know fleshly things because we're made of flesh. "But even so, the things of God knoweth no man but the Spirit of God. Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit which is of God, that we might know the things that are freely given to us of God, which things also we speak, not in the words which man's wisdom teacheth, but which the Holy Ghost teacheth, comparing spiritual things with spiritual. But the natural man receiveth not the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness unto him, neither can he know them, because they are spiritually discerned. But he that is spiritual judgeth all things, yet he himself is judged of no man." Judgment, godly judgment, and godly justice can only be carried out by those who have the Spirit of God. The natural man is always going to carry on, can only understand the things of the world. Godly judgment, you know, like you say, the natural man would have said, "Well, those people down there, they might be homosexuals, they might be vile, this, that, and the other thing, but we'll teach them other ways. We'll send them off to re-education camp, we'll do this, we'll do that, and, you know, we'll have a program, we'll start some social, you know."
Send
them to Dr. Phil. You know, this, that, or the other thing. God judged them, and he found them guilty. And I can understand that. I understand what the judgment was. As Paul says in verse 16, "For who hath known the mind of the Lord, that he may instruct it? But we have the mind of Christ." We have the mind of Christ. Well, you see here that Abraham had the mind of God. And he grew substantially in this conversation with God. And that was the purpose. God talked with him and taught him so that he would have the same mind as God, a godly mind. All right.